Blog Talk Radio.
And Amityville and in the church at a young age. And, you know, we're sitting at the pulpit, not at the pulpit, on the pulpit, after services. I was one of the first ministers to join his church when he first returned from Detroit. And for personal reasons, I left shortly thereafter. I had moved, basically. It wasn't anything, no, you know, it had nothing to do with the church per se. Let me just put it that way. I had just relocated from Long Island and felt that it was no longer feasible to travel to the church. You know, it was a converted supermarket. Right? You know, he brought it outright, you know, $40,000. He talked about it all the time, you know, in his sermons. And so anyway, long story short is... forgive me, that someone that obviously is not aware of my schedule, so if you could just bear with me one second, I will turn my cell off. So we were sitting, you know, I just wanted to touch bases with him, you know, because he was, this was a newly admitted ministry, and I wanted to ensure that we touch bases. And he was telling me about, you know, how, you know, the devil can't stop you from doing anything, but he can hinder you. And, you know, I never forgot that. And that was many, many years ago, you know, closer to 15 than it is to 1 year ago. So it was a very long time ago that we had that discussion. And so I I'm not saying that these people are the devil's acolytes or they're evil or wicked. They're just people being people. And I understand that. And to mitigate my stress, what I've done in my life, both personally and professionally, is I just I've eliminated these type of people from my life. It's that simple. You know, I have it down to a basic common denominator. It's not family or my children or my child. You know, I had a daughter. She's no longer with us. Then I don't. I'm not basically getting into it. It's not worth it. It's not worth it to my mental health. And you know, black males. And if you didn't know, I am a black male. Die relatively early, man, from a lot of stress-related issues, you know, and like, you know, the pastor was talking about in church yesterday, you know, we start self-medicating and don't even realize, and before you know it, man, you're drinking a gallon of vodka a night and not even realizing you're smoking a blunt or whatever, or, you know, so you're heavily engaging in, you know, anything to mute the pain of your existence. And so what I've done to prevent myself from doing that, man, is just, you know, praying, fasting, meditating, and just eliminating these toxic people from my life, really. And, you know, you can't always get around them, just like this phone call, you know. And the person probably didn't know. You know, I know what it was, and they didn't know. They just decided to, you know, not email, but to do what they do, which is to race to pick up the phone and to call, not realizing your schedule. And that's how that goes. So, you know, I just turned it off and keep it moving. So, you know, back to the show over the weekend. You know, there's a lot of noise about, you know, the latest outrage from this administration where, you know, a Saudi journalist, Khashoggi, and I talked about this a little last week, was brutally murdered in the Saudi embassy or consulate in Istanbul. Now, which poses, you know, a lot of problems. I mean, you know, beyond the moral outrage of murdering someone, is that you did it on a foreign soil in your consulate. So that raises the other issue of international treaties you know, because they violated the treaty. Because those consulates and embassies are the sovereign property by treaty of the country, not the host country, but the country who owns the consulate or embassy. And so when you are engaging, and this is, you know, this is a longstanding, you know, issue, when you're engaging in criminal activities such as murdering people, in your consulate, you know, that could be grounds for your consulate to be closed and you ousted from the country. Now, I don't know that you know, Saudi Arabia has very deep pockets, and yes, that weighs in because Chump, the brain dead comic carnival barker, aka Clueless the Clown, said so as much. Well, we have $1 billion in contacts and blah. What does that have to do with somebody getting killed? And see, this is where this administration is wholly immoral. I mean, because since when do we put a price tag on someone's life? You know, or some people more productive than others? Yes, of course. But, you know, human life is still precious nonetheless, and you cannot put a price tag on it. And so we're grappling with, well, we're not grappling with it, but the administration is grappling with how to deal with the Saudis moving forward. Because even Trump's allies in the Congress have said that, you know, if true, and the evidence is, I mean, because they change the story virtually on a daily basis. The Saudi ambassador was on the news shows this morning. I just briefly glanced at him in preparation for the show, saying that yes, he was murdered, and you know, nobody gave these guys permission. Well, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that if the crown prince's own bodyguards were the perpetrators of this heinous act, that the crown prince cannot be far away from complicity in this crime. Because these guys didn't just unilaterally decide to fly to Turkey from Saudi Arabia. Arabia, murder gruesomely, from what I understand. You know, they cut the guy's fingers off and beheaded him, and then you know, apparently dismembered. I mean, just boggles the imagination. I mean, you know, the cruelty and I mean, this is a really a national nightmare, and yeah, a lot of mental health professionals are saying that, man. You know, a lot of people are being personally impacted by the actions of this administration, because this guy just refuses to come out and condemn the Saudis. You know, because, you know, we have quote-unquote contracts, which is a high, you know, hyperbole. We don't have $1 billion in contracts with Saudi Arabia. We have, maybe $100 million, if not more, but certainly not $1 billion. And it certainly, you know, is not 600, you know, 1,000 people. I mean, it's probably a fraction of that. But that should not be a factor in how any moral administration moves forward. We used to be, I mean, you know, I have, and this is the issue that, you know, caused me to just shut down, period. You know, in this country, there used to be, we used to have integrity. There are virtually no systems left. And with the Supreme Court, which the federal judiciary used to be the crown jewel of jurisprudence in the world, on earth. And now it has devolved into a patronage mill. You know, people with, you know, partisan, racist, bigoted, incompetent, unethical, immoral hacks. And it's a shame. And Kavanaugh is case in point. So, and the state level has been like that for years. Every state, you know, you do better in the Northeast, however, but when you start heading past the Mason-Dixon line, then you start getting these hacks in there. That know somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody, and you cannot get justice in these courts. I'm a lawyer. I'm telling you for a fact that it is a shame where you have a meritorious complaint and it's either thrown out or thrown out for technical or what they call procedural reasons. And it's outrageous that this goes on. And with the elevation of Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court, man, it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. Trust me. And so now you have virtually no institution that acts as a safeguard for the common man. I mean, it's strictly who you know, and you have to pay to play. And I guess you could play that game if you want to, if you have deep enough pockets. But what does that say about you? And I guess that's where I'm going with the conversation this morning. That where do we go from here when all of our institutions are checks and balances fade from sight. You just fade to black. I mean, there is absolutely, with this latest confirmation battle, man, that was it. And, you know, I'm on social media. You know, I weigh in from time to time when I have the time. And I'm on a group of black guys, you know. Some of these guys are relatively conservative, and, you know, I take them to task for it. I say, hey, man, you know, conservatism is just racism masked by, you know, a semblance of civility, and you cannot go down that road. I mean, no, I don't agree with everything the so-called liberals do. I do not. I think that the Obama administration went overboard in some of its, you know, policies. You know, I'm not going to name those policies because this is not the show for that. But I, you know, some of the topics that were raised, I absolutely agree with the guy about. You know, and he's obviously, you know, a conservative leaning, you know, brother. I have a problem with that. And I, you know, anybody that listens to the show, and by the way, you can call in at 215-383-3872. Again, that number is 215-383-3872. You know, on some issues, I'm definitely conservative, absolutely. Whereas on others, I'm liberal. You know, social issues, most social issues, I'm relatively liberal. Most, not all. On fiscal issues, I'm relatively conservative. But I don't believe that going after the Social Security Trust Fund, Medicaid or Medicare, is the way to go because you want to give tax cuts to your cronies who don't need them. And they, by their own admission, they don't need them. I mean, how much money can you possibly spend in a lifetime? How much would you? Look, I have nowhere near that amount of money. I have virtually everything I want. I do. I really do. I can't have anything else, man. If I never got another material acquisition in my life, I have more than enough. More than enough. You know, and, you know, most of it goes to my son. Whatever he chooses to do with it is up to him, you know, when I pass from this earth. And I'm just saying that, I mean, how much is enough? It is just absolutely outrageous that these people feel that, forget about, you know, stagnant wages, you know, where they're saying the economy is white hot and roaring back to life. Yeah, for who? I mean, most of the jobs are in the service sector, which means that they're not paying anything. They're not paying a livable wage. I mean, if you live in any city on the East Coast in the United States, just the East Coast cities. Forget about, you know, the Midwest, the West, even the South, you know, or the West Coast. Let's just take the East Coast, for example. And I put this up on, I believe it was Twitter or Facebook, in response to some imbecile saying that, you know, rents are you know, I don't know what the argument was, that rents, you know, something, some ludicrous argument that the poster was trying to defend. So at any rate, if you make less than, especially, let's just take New York here, for example, Brooklyn. Years ago, when I returned from Europe, from, you know, I was in school there, and I came back home to finish up and to attend grad school before professional school. And yeah, I had a little disposable income, not a whole great deal, but I thought that, you know, I always was business-minded, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, enterprising, that sort of thing, industrious. So I said, hey, man, I love Brooklyn. I love the brownstones here. Let me see if I can get on with this. Mind you, this is 25 years ago. This is not, this didn't occur last year, the year before last, even 10 years ago or 15 years. This was 25 years ago. I returned from abroad. And at that time, the brownstones in Brooklyn, I'm talking about shells. I'm talking about brownstones that needed some work. I mean, they needed a rough rehab. I'm not saying that they, you know, they were uninhabitable, but they needed work. At that point, 25 years ago, I think the cheapest one that the broker showed me, English guy, as a matter of fact, he wasn't even American, but he, anyway, I don't know what he was, a resident alien or, you know, green card holder or something like that. Obviously, he had to work for it because he was selling real estate. And the cheapest one, I think, he wanted $244. I kid you not. Beautiful, beautiful brownstones. The one I liked was $285. I never forget it, you know, at the time. And I had nowhere near that money then. 25 years ago, I did not. You know, but now the point I'm trying to make now, those very same brownstones are going for $1 million+, and even shells in you know, Branford Marcellus. I know Spike Lee and Rosie Perez, all of them had brownstones down in at one point in oh my God, Jesus Christ, I don't know why I can't think of the name of this section of Brooklyn. It was just before downtown Brooklyn. Those that know that area know where I'm talking about. It's not Bed-Stuy. It's the next section. It'll come to me before the end of the show. As a matter of fact, let's take a quick break. And by that time, my memory might have come back, and I could tell you what section of Brooklyn this is. That these, all of them. Spike had a joint down. They call it Spike's Joint. I don't know if it's still there. I don't even know if they're still there. But that's what I want to talk about. As a matter of fact, it's a topic featured prominently in my book, if I can ever finish writing it. Let's take a break and come back on the other side of the break.
The Endangered Species Act of 1973 was signed into law by President Richard M. Nixon on December 28, 1973. It was designed to protect critically imperiled species from extinction as a consequence of economic growth and development untempered by adequate concern and conservation. The U.S. Supreme Court found that the plain intent of Congress in enacting the ESA was to halt, reverse the trend towards species extinction, whatever the cause. A species is considered to be endangered if it's in danger of extinction throughout its lifespan or a significant portion of its habitat is threatened, destroyed, or invaded, or if it is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future. Then why are black boys on this list? Black boys are an endangered species. Please go to GoFundMe and to our campaign at /PLZ2MO and contribute generously to help us build an alternative school for these boys that will become a national model for educational innovation. Again, go to GoFundMe and to our campaign at /PLZ2MO.
Back tuned into the Marketing Pulpit in Nashville, New York. This is yours truly, Dennis Shipman. 47 degrees, so went up a degree since we've been on the air, and cloudy here in Brooklyn. I was talking about not downtown Brooklyn, but you know, Bed-Stuy, just before, you know, because I know that these three entertainers, or not entertainers, but celebrities, had brownstones down there. And I wasn't trying to get a brownstone there. I was deeper in Bed-Stuy, which is still a beautiful area. And it's been historically black. But now you see more and more Europeans in the area, you know, where they you know, they wouldn't venture, 30 years ago. So now, like I was saying, in relation to the wages in the white hot economy and that sort of thing, you know, if you live in that area down there, man, I mean, I used to look at the rents, and this is, you know, roughly that time, 25 years ago, the rents at that point were $13, $14, $15, $16, $17, $1,800 a month for one bedroom. I kid you not. Who could pay that, man? I mean, just think about it. If, you know, if you're making $15 an hour, how much is that? And that means that you're paying almost two-thirds of your salary in rent. So you have to, and I know, as a matter of fact, I had a friend that I was seeing at the time, and she was a psychiatrist at Yale, and one of her buddies lived on the Lower East Side, not in Brooklyn, but on the Lower East Side. I'm not sure what she did. I wasn't curious, I just didn't ask her, but, you know, I would assume that, you know, being that they were associates and friends and buddies and that sort of thing, that she was well-educated and, you know, just assuming that she had a decent job. And she had a little, I swear to God, man, it was like a cubby that she shared with another young woman because she apparently could not afford the rent. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, even with a white-hot economy, if you're working, you know, one, two, or two and a half jobs or one and a half jobs, to make ends meet, man, that is wholly unfair. That is just not fair. I mean, you know, you could talk about how energized the economy is, but if those jobs generated as a consequence of this economy aren't paying livable wages, I'm talking about, you know, in a city like New York. This was years ago. I don't know what it is now. I have to look it up and give you the numbers. But many, many years ago, it was like you needed almost $100,000 a year to live in New York. And I don't see how anyone making less than that can. I really don't. You know, unless you live in the outer boroughs. But like I said, even some sections of Brooklyn, even the Bronx now, which, you know, nobody wanted to live in the Bronx, except people that, well, you know, grew up there, you know, and had friends there and that sort of thing. You know, those areas, certain areas, you know, going towards the Westchester County line are really outrageously expensive now. So, well, at any rate, we're going to talk more about this next week, and, you know, we're coming up fast. I thought I was going to be doing some poll judging, but they didn't call me. They no longer need my services, which is cool. You know, I'll work and make some money and just watch the polls like everybody else on the television. As a matter of fact, I got to get out of here either today or tomorrow and vote because there's early voting. And I'll find out what happens, and hopefully you will as well. But I urge everyone, whoever you choose to vote for, just vote. Have a nice day. And
yeah. war.